Call the Regulated Industries Committee to order. Representative Peterson moves the approval of the minutes. Any discussion?
They look good, thank you.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. First bill up on the calendar is Representative Abler. House File 1812. Representative Abler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the motion would be to go to the floor and perhaps hear debate and decide if
the chair will move House File 1812 be. Oh, right. We need to first adopt the conference of the division report. The chair will move the adoption of the division report on HF 1812. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Representative Erickson will move the approval. Moves the approval of HF 1812 be recommended to pass and referred to the House floor.
Well, thank you, Chair Westrom. I certainly will move that.
Okay. I knew that. So, Representative Abler, why don't you tell us briefly about your bill? We do have other bills on the agenda, so we need to try to wrap this up in probably a half hour or less.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and that's our intention, too. We have absolutely about no testimony, except to suggest that at the end of this, you might be so enamored that it might be a consent calendar bill, but the committee can decide that at the end. Just to summarize, the two elements of this bill, maybe not consent calendar. Anyway, there's two elements to the bill. One, which would be to allow for the card club, which comes in year two anyway, to come in year one, to allow better purses and that agreement has been made with the people who care about that. And the other part has to do with the simulcasting. And that would allow for the, this track will never be allowed to simulcast thoroughbred. This bill can go forward, they'll be allowed to simulcast that. And that's been worked out, and that's part of the agreement that was made in the division and the amendment that was brought there. There's a ton of local support, Mr. Chair. There's a little bit of opposition remaining in the town, although this committee is not going to pass to decide if the track goes forward or not. That decision has been made elsewhere. The only decision today is about these two elements, which will allow this very good idea to be a little more successful and achieve the purpose to which it's designed. So with that, Mr. Chair, we can stand for questions. We'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Is there any other proponents that you have that want to testify in favor of this?
Mr. Chair, it's been discussed. The members are fully informed, so just to save time, we don't have any proponents, although there's a lot who could testify. We'll hold that.
Representative Abler, question I have. As you said, this is the bill is narrowed to the two issues of card club starting sooner and then the simulcasting. What provision or what's the process for the card club to start? And it's on the assumption that then the horse track is soon there to follow. But what would prevent the card club from being in operation for 5 or 10 years before the horse track would ever be built? Is there a way that there would be an assurance that essentially the card club would begin, which this bill would provide for earlier starting for that, but such that it wouldn't just be a way to have a card club start without a horse track?
Exactly, Mr. Chair, and that cannot go forward. To comment on that, Mr. Duff is here. He can give you the specifics.
Okay, that'd be great. And then let's move to the other testimony. I understand we have a couple from the opposition side.
Chairman Westrom, my name is Jim Druck, and I am one of the partners in North Metro Harness Initiative. Current Minnesota law provides that you must run 50 days of racing at a minimum in any year to operate a card club in that year, and all we are doing is asking for the opportunity to accelerate that so that we can operate the card club in the first year before we run the 50 days. We are required in this bill to have 50 days of racing assigned to us by the Minnesota Racing Commission. If we don't run those days, After that, we will not get a subsequent license for card room or for horse racing. So I believe that the concern you have is well protected in the current law, and there's no change to that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Otherwise, we'll have tests. I understand there's a couple people that would like to testify against this bill. John McCarthy. John McCarthy, and then a citizens group. Ann Gabriel, you'll be next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McCarthy, welcome to the committee. As you know, we've got other bills on the agenda. If you could try to keep your comments within about 5 minutes, that would be great. I think we've got three testifiers in opposition. Thank you.
I will try to do that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is John McCarthy. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association. Our association represents 9 of the 11 federally recognized tribes within the state of Minnesota. Tribes are geographically located in rural communities throughout the state. I'm here today to oppose House File 1812. Our association is solidly on record opposing all proposals to expand gambling in Minnesota. We oppose this specific bill because it establishes the groundwork for major gambling expansion. These proposals represent what we believe is a slippery slope to turning Minnesota into Las Vegas. This is bad for Minnesota, bad for tribal governments and the local governments who use tribal gaming revenue to benefit not only the tribal members but also residents of the rural communities where they're located. Our members understand that state law allows for a second track in the metro area. We've always supported the horse industry and the agribusiness associated with it. If this issue were simply about horse racing, we'd not be here today testifying against this proposal. We also believe that Representative Abler is well-intended in offering this bill and that his motives are clearly to help the Minnesota horse industry. Our concern is not with the horse racing aspect of this legislation, but rather with the casino gambling, which is what we believe is the real goal of the owners, investors, and supporters from Southwest Casino Corporation. The company name alone sends a loud and clear message that this isn't about what they like to describe as a racetrack where a family can enjoy a Sunday afternoon of family entertainment. The goal of Southwest Casino Corporation is to own and operate another casino property. That's what they do. That's how they define themselves in their business. Sadly, the only way for them to get there for that next casino property is through the racetrack. I know that they have said this is not their plan and that they are not interested in a casino in Columbus Township, but when we look at their record, it points in a different direction. In February of 2004, Southwest Casino signed a letter of intent to sell 50% of its company to MTR Gaming Group. This company owns and operates casinos in Las Vegas, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. In February of 2005, it was reported that Southwest Casino tried to sell off the controlling interest in their company to Mr. Gordon Graves, a major manufacturer of casino gaming devices. In both these instances, Southwest Casino has attempted to bring major casino companies with direct ties to Vegas into this project. While Southwest Casino may not plan to try and open a casino in Anoka County, who can vouch for the outstate partners who they want to sell to? We often hear that the tribe's position on no expansion is hypocritical and that the tribes are expanding every day. I'm sure you've all heard Senator Day tell the news media that, as we speak, slot machines are being unloaded at tribal casinos. Well, that simply isn't the case. Tribal casinos have seen less than a 4% increase in the number of machines in the last 6 years. Keep in mind that in many instances, these tribes open their facilities in temporary buildings, or in some cases, poor buildings. Increased machines were part of the initial plan for the permanent facilities. More importantly, the tribes have honored the agreements that they negotiated and signed in 1989 and 1990. They have not asked for additional games, nor have they moved beyond the boundaries of the reservation as per the agreement in the compact. Tribes view the negotiated compacts as the law. They abide by them as they abide by other laws and other agreements. When Southwest Casino was licensed to conduct racing within the state of Minnesota, they knew the rules. We understand that by law they can have a racetrack, and under the laws they eventually will have a kart club. The same case applies to the issue of simulcasting. They knew the rules when they applied. Why should an exception be made for this group and not for others? In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I believe that this proposal sets a bad precedent by making special exceptions to a law that was designed to ensure that a company proved that it's capable and qualified to operate a bona fide horse racing operation within the state of Minnesota. Change the rules for this group, excuse the pun, puts the cart before the horse and makes the law appear to be much more about card clubs than racetracks. If this proposed track can't show a profit as a standalone racetrack business, then maybe the investors should reconsider their investment strategy. Waiting periods are established for a reason. Rules are put in place so that everyone will have the same opportunity, will come in using the same criteria. I urge this committee to consider the request before you and vote against waiving the rules on this proposal. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Westrom. Mr. McCarthy, this is a horse harness race, and you said Minnesota would become a Las Vegas if we would approve this bill. I don't think Las Vegas has horse harness racing. So in what way would this make us a Las Vegas?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Erickson, we're not objecting to the racetrack. The racetrack is allowable under state law. What we're concerned with and would object to is the potential for a casino, which is what we believe will be the next phase of this operation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
You also said that they claim they provide family entertainment. Do the casinos provide family entertainment? The Indian gaming casinos?
The casinos, in terms of their hotels and their golf courses, I guess would be considered family entertainment. I don't believe that gambling casinos and playing slot machines is family entertainment from the perspective of children.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCarthy, you said you've only added 4% in slot machines, I believe is what you were referring to. How many different kinds of games are played on your casino slot machines? Could you tell us about that, please?
Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, there is a myriad of games that are played under the compact in the tribal casinos in Minnesota. There are no games that are being played that are not under the compact. I couldn't venture to guess the variety of games. It all depends on how technical you want to get with that issue. There are what you call a slot machine, and there are what you would call a game of chance, which may be a video poker type of game. So, and some machines offer a menu that you can play a variety of other games. But again, all of the games that are offered are under current law allowable and under the compact allowable.
Mr. Chair, just a question for you. Do we allow games of chance?
Say that again.
Does the state of Minnesota have games of chance that are legal? Maybe Ms. Long.
Ms. Long, I'll let answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I guess I'm not sure exactly what you mean by the term games of chance.
Well, Madam, Mr. Chair and Ms. Long, I know we have the lottery, but do we have, we don't have poker any place, do we? Or Keno, or those kinds of games of chance, to which I think Mr. McCarthy is referring.
Ms. Long.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I guess in addition to the games that are at a card club, at Canterbury's Card Club, there are, is the private social bet exemption under Minnesota law that allows certain forms of betting. Other than that, I'm not aware of any authorization to speak of.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
Ms. Long, those are private social betting games, though, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes.
Representative Peterson. Did you say?
Thank you.
Emmer. Okay.
Thank you, Representative
Emmer.
Mr. McCarthy, before you leave, welcome back. I just had one point of clarification, and you made the statement that it's authorized in law, but we had that discussion last week about slot machines, and I'll again just make mention before I ask you to clarify something. There's nothing in our Minnesota state law that uses the term slot machine and authorizes it. But that being said, you made this statement about the 4%. In fact, sir, I believe it's Mystic Lake, within the last 5 years has added 400 slot machines, so at a rate of over 100 a year. Isn't that true?
Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the figures in front of me. I'm talking about an aggregate of machines in Minnesota, Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Reimer.
I understood that, Mr. McCarthy, and I want to make sure that people are clear, because sometimes numbers can be misleading. When you take percentages, does it sound like I'm in the ballpark? Because I have reason to understand that, I believe it's Mystic Lake has added 400 slot machines in the last 5 years.
Mr. McCarthy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I would have to check on that. I'm not absolutely sure. I can assure you that they've added some slot machines. I don't know what the number is. In relation to your earlier question and comment regarding state law, you have 22 compacts in Minnesota, and we view those as state law, and they do allow for the play of the games that we're currently playing. So I don't know where the confusion is on that. If, in fact, Minnesota did not allow that, we would not be having these compacts.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. We'll have Ann. Ann Gabriel from the Citizens Group. And then Ann Hentges? Hikus. Ann Hikus will be the last testifier in opposition. Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and if you could try to keep your comments within 5 minutes, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Deb Davies. I'm the treasurer of the Columbus Concerned Citizens, and this is Don Steinke. He's our chair. Ann Gabriel is out of town this week. I had talked to Brian Fahey, and he had put our names on the agenda. And we're going to start with our chairman.
Okay. Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Okay. My name is Don Steinke.
John?
Don. D-O-N.
Don.
Yeah, we should have been on the agenda. We didn't register ahead of time.
Hold on here, Brian. So do you know Ann Gabriel?
Yes. She's our communication coordinator. She is out of town.
Oh, I see. So you're in her place.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's fine.
Yes, sir.
Could you spell your last name for us for the
record? First name is D-O-N. Last name is S-T-E-I-N-K-E.
Last two letters?
K-E.
K-E.
Yes, sir.
Okay. However you want to proceed, whichever one of you wants to talk.
Okay, I'll get you first. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Again, my name is Don Steinke. I'm from Columbus Township, and I'm the chairman of the Columbus Concerned Citizens, a 501c4 corporation. We are a grassroots, all-volunteer, nonprofit corporation formed to educate the citizens of our community on important issues. We have no paid lobbyists or staff. The 700-plus members of our organization signed a petition in 2004 opposing the location of a harness track and card room in our community. The House file before you today, House File 1812, would change at least two key provisions to the state statute 240. We are very opposed as a group to any change to the original 240 language to allow simulcasting of all breeds at this facility and to eliminate the requirement to run a season or 50 days of live racing before the card room can begin operation. Both of these provisions have been in the law since it was written. The applicant was always aware that these were the provisions that he was going to be operating under after he was licensed. In fact, he has tried unsuccessfully to have these same provisions changed in the 2003, 2004, and 2005 legislative sessions. The CCC has been told from the beginning that this was a harness track with a card room, not a card room with a harness track. If this is all about racing horses, then let's have a year of racing, as the law presently requires, and see how it goes. From everything we have been told, the racetrack will be a huge success. Canterbury was required to operate under these same provisions and did not come before you to get the provision changed even before they began operations. It's becoming clearer by the day that the horse racing industry is being used as a scapegoat to allow for the expansion of gambling, where the real money is. If we are truly talking about a racetrack, then do not change the law to allow North Metro to forget about racing. House File 1812 will change the focus of this facility towards a card room and the addition of a casino to the Columbus facility. North Metro already has plans for the grandstand area to include 157,000 square feet for a casino. We are asking you to defeat House File 1812. It has no reason to pass except to allow North Metro Harness Initiative, the developer of the project in Columbus Township, the opportunity to substantially increase their profits and allow for the accelerated expansion of gambling in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Stank.
Stanky.
Okay. Is that it for your testimony, or
Deb Davies would like to offer?
Yes, I'm okay. Deb Davies. I am the treasurer for the Columbus Concerned Citizens, and before I begin, I'd like to point out that the preliminary testimony that I had submitted, that's in your packet, is incorrect. Please disregard it. I will make that testimony available to you after I've finished. I want you to know that I live in and am also a small business owner in Columbus Township. I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 1812 because it permits North Metro Harness and MHI to open a card club before completing the required 50 days of live racing and permits all breeds simulcasting. You may have been told that the opposition to North Metro has disappeared due to the latest results of the township board elections. Unfortunately, candidates Jim Marshall and Marge Hughes are unable to testify today due to previous commitments, so I will try to set the record straight. The recent election was about stopping annexation by Forest Lake. The election was not about the harness track. Those who won the election, Mark Walsh and Renee Fry, bombarded Columbus residents with vote to stop annexation messages, as you're seeing on the overhead. The challengers, Marshall and Hughes, also campaigned against annexation. In addition, they are opposed to Southwest Casino's proposed development, but they are rookies. In other words, they've never run for election before. And despite the odds, Marshall and Hughes received almost 40% of the vote. According to Ms. Hughes, that's also about the same number of residents who got past the confusion over the vote to stop annexation issue. In other words, when Hughes randomly visited a household, about 60% of the time the voters were confused. They thought the annexation was on the ballot, but it was not. In addition, candidate Marshall reports 99% of the households he randomly visited opposed North Metro. This proves the opposition to North Metro remains strong in our area. Southwest Casino is a 50% owner in North Metro Harness Initiative, with the other 50% owned by MTR Harness, a subsidiary of MTR Gaming of West Virginia. According to the SEC 2005 third quarter filings of Southwest Casino Corp., the total financial contributions to the harness track were over $12 million. Plus, an additional $1.5 million were invested for future needs. I would refer to the 2005 fourth quarter and year-end SEC filings, but they will not be public until this Friday, March 31st. Also noted in the SEC quarterly filings was a $2.5 million note for this facility backed by Southwest Casino Corp. and 12 of its key stockholders. This note is due to be paid off April of 2007. But that's not all. In this SEC report, Southwest Casino says it will still need additional funds to move forward and complete the estimated $45 million project. House File 1812 will generate an immediate cash flow to support this facility, which seems to be a cash-strapped operation before construction has even begun. In fact, according to Columbus Town Board minutes, North Metro knew on August 13, 2003 that it would need to change State Statute 240 to generate adequate operating revenue. In other words, North Metro has known all along this isn't a viable business. As a business owner and a Carrollton School graduate, I must ask you, is it the job of the Minnesota legislature to cater to a business that is not viable on its own accord? And why change the statutes to benefit a business that is currently not operating and whose capital financial investment will be unable to support itself under our current statutes? CCC Chairman Don Steinke and I are both small business owners. Don is in agriculture and I'm in manufacturing. We have survived the ups and downs in our different industries for many years, but we have one major issue in common. We have not requested changes in the law in order to become profitable. House File 1812 is designed to benefit only one future business in an industry where declining revenues are becoming the norm. The CCC's opposition to the North Metro facility has not wavered. In many public meetings, North Metro promised our community a family-friendly harness track. Make them honor their promise in Statute 240 and give us only a harness track first. I ask you to please defeat House File 1812 and stop this accelerated expansion of gambling in our state. Thank you again for allowing us to speak to you today.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. Any questions?
Sure. General Adkins. Just a quick one for either of the two witnesses. I was under the impression that the city council election and the township elections had been essentially a referendum on the track. So I appreciate your testimony. Has there been a referendum or a citizen? We had this issue kind of come up last week with respect to Canterbury, and I think it was pointed out particularly across the way that the people had kind of spoken down in Shockton. They were very supportive and that I should keep my nose out of it or something akin to that. But has it been figured out in Columbus Township? Has there been a referendum or is there going to be a referendum? Or can you kind of...
There has not been a referendum. It was requested of the town board to have a referendum. That request was turned down. Opposition, we did present the petition to the town board in 2004 with the 714 signatures on it opposed to this track. At that point, nothing was done to address the concerns of the citizens who were against the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Adkins.
Just a question of, are there members of the town board here?
I don't know. Is there anybody on the town board here?
It does not appear.
I don't think so.
Thank you.
Or any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Westrom. To either of you, is Columbus Township opposed to the horse harness racetrack, or are you opposed to what you think might happen if we would okay a horse harness racetrack? Actually, we don't do that anyway.
No, you don't do that anyway. No.
that's a done deal. That's already over. So,
which is a good point, Representative Erickson. We should keep the discussion tailored to the card club provision and the simulcast.
But let me ask the question anyway. Is Columbus Township opposed to the horse harness race?
I don't believe that the... If this was really a harness track, mm-hmm. I don't think we would have the opposition that you've got.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. Mr. Steinke, you said that there's a 700-plus members. Is that all local members or are those statewide members?
Those members are all in Columbus Township. The initial petition had 200 and some other names on there that were from the area, the Forest Lake area, but they are not included. So we had over 900, but we're only addressing the people that are Columbus residents.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steinke, how many residents are in the township?
It's just over 4,000 residents.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually would like either Representative Abler or his testifier to respond to the letter, the testimony that we received with the statement being North Metro already has plans for a grandstand area to include 157,000 square feet for a racino.
Representative Abler, do you have any answer response to that?
Mr. Chair, I'll let Mr. Druck answer that question.
All right.
If I may.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is not accurate. All we have plans for is the harness track and card room that has been licensed by the Minnesota Racing Commission.
Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll have the Ann Hikas. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I guess I'll ask Mr. Stanky where he got that information.
Mr. Stanky?
That information came from the environmental assessment worksheet that was presented to the township by the developer and accepted by the township. I didn't pull it out of thin air. I guess there's 4,000 people, but 2,400 voters. I was counting the total. There we go.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sankey and Ms. Davis. Ms. Hikas?
Yes.
Welcome to our committee. Please proceed. Try to keep it under 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Angela Hikas, and I'm the Vice President of Gaming Planning Analysis for the Mille Lacs Band Corporate Commission. The Mille Lacs Band is responsible for operating Grand Casino Hinkley and Grand Casino Mille Lacs. And I know many of you have heard my message before, but I'm here today also in opposition to the acceleration of card club operations at the North Metro Harness Track, really eliminating the provision for the specified number of live racing days. And this opposition is coming not only due to the impact that really this acceleration of a season would have on the Mille Lacs Band, but really the impact that it has on the job creation that we've been able to do and really the economic development that we've been able to do in the two rural communities where our casinos exist. Grand Casino Hinkley exists in Hinkley, Minnesota, and Grand Casino Mille Lacs in Onamia, Minnesota. So we really are proud of that economic development that we've brought into those two particular regions, and in consideration of a lot of this expansion and acceleration, it's really talking about impact, not only to us, but really to those rural communities with which we operate. I've talked before about impact, but I just want to spend a few minutes kind of reiterating. Given where we're located, many may believe that we're well north of the Twin Cities metro area and that impact or activity expansion of gaming in that area does not have much of an impact on us. But given really the evaluation of the market and the analysis that we do, we really understand where our gamers are coming from, and a significant amount of our market comes from the Twin Cities metro area and really those kind of northern tier suburbs. So looking at what's really being proposed here in this acceleration, location is such a key impact on really what drives individuals, drives consideration to these facilities, and where this facility is proposed to go, obviously, is really in the major market corridor, most prevalently where Grand Casino Hinkley is. So there's definitely an increase of ease of access to this particular location. So that's where we're kind of driving that impact from. Also, from a lot of our analysis, the Minnesota is a market that is a mature gaming market. So kind of this expansion of gaming dollars is really shifting around. There's not a lot of, I think, gaming, rather people just kind of waiting to happen to kind of frequent this particular facility. So having said that, and given a significant portion of what is really coming from that market, we see that as a dramatic impact. We see fewer guests. We see lower revenues, and a result of that, of course, fewer jobs. And then the whole relation of what that's allowed us to do, the economic impact of those jobs. Between our two facilities, we employ over 3,000 people. We offer health care benefits to those people, which means about 4,500 covered lives. And those jobs are held by 94% of the people are not Native American that are holding those jobs. there's really a decrease, of course, into the number of traffic flow that are coming to those entities, so the related economic development, job benefit that is spun off as a result of what we're doing in those areas is significant. So really what we're talking about here, and certainly we understand that this operation has the ability to open, but our opposition comes from that acceleration and really kind of this more advanced ability for impact to our entities. And most significantly, I think what we want to talk about is really that job loss. We're talking about job loss from those rural communities into the metro area, jobs that are very difficult to recreate in the areas that we have built our entities, built our facilities, built those jobs, given really economic viability back to those rural communities. So as you're contemplating this particular bill, I guess we'd like you to think about what is currently in place already, what is currently allowed, and really take into consideration what the impact is to the rural communities in Minnesota for accelerating the offering at the Fitness Card Club. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Westrum. Ms. Heikes, John McCarthy said in his testimony either last week or the week before that there are 7 card clubs within the Indian gaming industry. Could you identify where those 7 are?
Ms. Heikes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can only speak for Grand Casino Mille Lacs and Grand Casino Hinckley. In our operations, we offer table games and we do offer poker.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Heikes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Just about a 30-second comment.
Yeah, any response, and then we've got...
I know, I'm going to be brief. I just want to remind members...
We've got a few amendments, and then...
And this is the amendments partly, and then I'll be shorter about those. I want to remind members what the bill is. It's just to do 2 dinky things about a card club that's going to... or a card club harness trap that's going to go forward anyway. Most of the testimony you heard was people wishing this would not be. What is... project exists or not is far down the purview of this committee or above of this legislature, although we could repeal it, I suppose. So that's just to keep the, and we didn't bring a cartload of supporters, Mr. Chair, but I do have letters from 14 different groups that are the local regional entities, including the Columbus Board, which in 2003 unanimously supported a letter, and they talked in that letter in 2003 about the horse track and the card club, and they don't talk about a casino back in 2003. So the intention of this is to have a card club to accompany a track, and the card club is certainly going to make somebody some money, but it's going to make the purses bigger, which is the point. And when Canterbury agreed to the 1-year delay in the law, they'd been racing for a long time, so they agreed to nothing. And so now as you put this into play, is that a reasonable way to do business, and it's easier to make it successful, to create our own jobs. And I don't think this is going to dent anybody else, especially since what they're worried about is going to go forward anyway. The simulcasting is a de minimis effect on my friends. I'm not trying to hurt any of the tribal things. I vote no on things that hurt them. So if this is a bill just for this entity, it's not going to be a vehicle. And if you want to see the 14 letters from the different groups, I can pass that around. Otherwise, that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair. We can stand for amendments now.
All right. Thank you. With that, we've got some amendments. They're handed out. They're in the packet. Which one should we...
Mr. Chair, those are the A1 through A4 amendments are my own, and I do not intend to offer them.
Representative Atkins doesn't intend to offer A1 through A4. Representative Emmer?
Yeah.
You have the DE1 with the replacement?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I have. I actually submitted the DE1, but it should have been the D4, which I have in my hand for the members.
Do you have those?
Yes. They're being passed out right now. And if you'd like, I'll quickly comment.
Go ahead.
Members, this is the same amendment that was offered last week, so I'll save the long speech about the real social costs that nobody seems to want to speak about when we talk about legalized gaming in the state of Minnesota. We have witnesses that come to the table in bills like this and make statements that we don't want to see Minnesota become another Las Vegas, and yet the very interest that that witness represents is in today operating Las Vegas-style gaming, and it's prevalent throughout the state. I believe the social costs are significant to the point that we should really look at prohibiting all gambling in the state of Minnesota. I'm offering the same amendment that was offered last week onto a similar bill that Representative Beard presented, and that's enough. Thank you for considering it.
Representative Emmer, I understand there's not enough copies of that amendment out. Representative Beard will offer his up. Is anybody that wants to pass it over to somebody that doesn't have one?
Nobody wants one.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you for your courtesy.
Otherwise, I understand the page is making some more, but we might need to lay this bill and amendment on the table and move on until we get copies if we don't get enough. Is there anybody that needs copies that doesn't have one yet, members?
I got one. Yep.
Everybody got one?
Yes.
If you need one. Well, with that, any debate? We heard this testimony on this last week, Representative Emmer. I don't support this amendment, but Representative Abler, maybe your comments, and then Representative Atkins, did you have something to say?
I'd be interested to hear from Representative Abler.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a copy. Is this a repeal of gambling in Minnesota?
Yes. Is that a friendly amendment? That's really all we need to know.
I kind of like it, Mr. Chair, but this is the wrong bill for that, and so maybe a different day. Let me comment about amendments. If this bill succeeds and gets to the floor, and if it leaves, if the Senate has a companion, this is not the omnibus gaming bill. This is the two things about our harness track in Columbus bill. And it's my, I'm not here to be a vehicle for any. I know this is a very controversial topic. I'm barely in the topic, Mr. Chair, just a little nose in the tent, and I'm not going back to the tent any more times.
All right.
But so this is a topic far beyond the scope of this bill, and I would suggest that maybe put on a different bill on a different day, but please not mine.
Well said. Representative Hoppe.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll wait and I'll pass.
Anybody else have any discussion they need to say about this amendment? Anybody in the audience need to testify different than what was talked about on this before? Seeing none, no further discussion. All those in favor of this amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Any other amendments to this bill?
Mr. Chair, we ask for a roll call.
Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins asked for a roll call. I think we're on the bill, aren't we?
On the bill.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Representative Abler. Representative Abler, is there a Senate companion to this bill?
Yes, Representative Abler. And Representative Darius.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, who's the Senate author?
Senator Schein.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Westrom?
Yes.
Beard?
Aye.
Sharon?
Pass.
Emmer?
Yes.
Erickson?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hackbarth?
Yes.
Hoppe?
Yes.
Lanning?
Yes.
Powell?
Nope.
Simpson?
Yes.
Westerberg?
Yes.
Zeller?
Yes.
Anderson?
Aye. No.
Atkins?
No.
Hansen?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Lesh?
Pass.
Pass is in the pass, or?
Passes and pass.
I just lost my place there.
This one's next.
This one's it. Peterson?
No.
Rude?
No.
Keaton?
No.
Walker? Walker?
No.
Is that a no?
It's a no.
That's a no.
Jerome votes aye.
Jerome votes aye.
Flesh votes aye.
Flesh votes aye.
Motion prevails 13 to 11.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Abler. Thank you, members of your company.
Thank you.
Next, members, just to give a quick landscape of the committee, and I think you got the email from Brian yesterday pertaining to the Mercury bill and another bill that deals with energy issues. Early on in session, Senator Anderson and I agreed on a small energy bill that we would use as a common vehicle, so we line up with the Senate and the House, albeit it might be different language than in the House versus the Senate, but that is House File 3542. There's also a House File 3541 on the agenda. In the email Brian sent out yesterday, if you have bills or amendments that you would like to turn into amendments or amendments to dealing with energy, that would be the bill to have them drafted for. We will continue this schedule tomorrow, and what we don't wrap up tomorrow, which we will likely take up into next week. I don't envision we will finish everything tomorrow, and then we would have next week. We do have the room reserved for Monday night and Tuesday night if needed. I don't think we need all those times, but just as an FYI, I'm trying to pass out the final bill to match up with what the Senate passed last week or will pass by tonight. So that's kind of the landscape. I know some have asked about bill hearings. I have told them to take their bill and turn it into an amendment, and I'm even willing to, if it's a full bill, to avoid some of the extra paperwork. I'm willing to entertain the thought of just adding a bill in its entirety as an amendment. I've seen that happen in some committees before, but if possible, have Mr. Eloff just turn it into an amendment. But please try to get them in. If you have any more, we will. I think the ones we do have, we can get copies to research staff, or you can get them. We don't have them in the packets because we don't expect to probably get to many amendments today, and that way we don't lose them over the night if people leave them laying on the table. But they are available. I think we've got three or four or so amendments right now, mostly pertaining to the Mercury bill, Representative Hackbart's bill. The other thing, members, we were waiting to try to get an engrossed copy of the Senate bill to look at using some of that language that we may agree upon as a an amendment to House File 3542 to get the bill in its initial shape, and then we would amend it from there and have that discussion from there. But we would take provisions. I know Representative Beard has a bill that the Senate rolled into theirs. They've modified the current 3542 with agreements from different parties. And so to try to get up to speed, we'll probably take several of those provisions and make into one amendment. And that language just came over today, and so that should help Mr. Eloff in drafting amendments as well. So that's kind of the lay of the land. We will start and get testimony on the three bills on the agenda today, move into tomorrow with any finishing testimony, and then start on amendments. And I'll keep you posted on the schedule of whether we go tomorrow night or lay it over until Monday or Tuesday of next week. And so with that, let's start with House File 3541. Okay. I'm going to turn this over to the representative here.
Chair Westrom, welcome to the committee. And if you'd like to move your bill 3541, is your intention to have a vote on this today or to...
No, I would move it to the general register, I believe, but my intent would be to have Mr. Elwood come up here, explain this and the next bill, and then open it up for any testimony or questions, but then in not too long, lay them on the table, and then we...
We'll take them up tomorrow.
Take them up tomorrow after we get Representative Hackbarth's bill up for more testimony. And, Mr. Chair, before I forget, that last motion sent it to the House floor. I think it was supposed to... No, I'm...
For 3541, you mean?
No. I think it was supposed to go to the House floor.
Okay, Chair Westrum moves that House File 3541 be moved, recommended to pass and moved to the general register, I believe, is what you're trying to say. But members, just so we all know the lay of the land, there will be no vote taken on this bill today. The intention will be to hear, have some testimony, ask questions, and then lay it on the table, and we'll take it up again tomorrow. Is there a testifier in the audience that would like
Mr. to... Mr. Elwood, is he...
Chair Westrum? Ma'am, if you'd state your name for the record, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Pam Marshall, not Ron Elwood. But I am here to speak in favor of House File 3541. Basically, this bill requires utilities to report information year-round that they currently report during the cold weather period from April 15th to October 15th. The only addition to that report that they already provide asks them to give information about the number of accounts that have been reconnected to utility service each month. The organizations that support this bill, including AARP and Legal Services and others, believe that tracking the effect of utility costs on low-income customers is critical to designing effective programs and policies to help ensure that Minnesotans retain essential energy service. For example, if the number of service disconnections remain high throughout, particularly this next spring and summer, that we should consider the possibility of running a year-round energy assistance program instead of the one that we typically run from October to May. Similarly, the state might consider how we operate our energy assistance crisis program in order to prevent disconnections or to get people reconnected in the fall. Such programs can help us, and reports can help us design the most effective utility programs, targeting customers, setting meaningful benefit levels, and evaluating the impact of those efforts on subsequent disconnections and reconnections. And, Mr. Chair and members, a revised version of this bill was passed in the Senate with the input of many utility representatives and other consumer advocates and senior citizen organizations. And we understand that there is no opposition to the Senate version of that bill. And so we hope that tomorrow or whenever time permits that language can be adopted in place of the current version that you have of House File 3541.
Right.
And that's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this witness in particular? Are there other members of the audience who would like to testify in favor of this bill? Is there anyone that would like to testify in opposition to this bill? This is easy, Chair Westrum. Any questions at all?
Funny, Mr. Chair, they didn't like the language in the Senate, but they don't mind it here. So, no, we intend to look at the Senate language and either bring that forward or if there's objections to that.
Chair Westrum, please repeat that again.
I said the intention is to bring the Senate language forward that the different groups have worked on, and if there's objection to that by committee members here, we will even modify it further. So.
Okay. With that, we're prepared to lay it on the table, but I do see a question from Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Beard. Ms. Marshall, you said AARP and legal aid were among the supporters. You said others. Could you mention some of those others?
Mr. Chair and Representative, as I recall, the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, the Minnesota Community Action Association, a number of others signed a letter of support that was submitted on the Senate side. And again, we did work, it may sound easy over here, but we actually worked long and hard with representatives from the utility companies to get to a point where there was no opposition to that language that passed the Senate. It's a very similar language to what you have here. It's been shortened and modified somewhat, but it's my understanding that the utilities are willing to provide the information that they're basically providing during the heating season on a year-round basis. That's really all it says.
Okay. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Westrum, the LIHEAP program is basically and has always basically been supported by the federal government. With a few years exceptions, this being one of them, we've had no state input. Is it your understanding who would support the rest of the year around if the federal government only supports it during the cold weather period?
Representative Westrum.
Well, Mr. Chair, probably left up to the state or county or something else, but and I'm not advocating necessarily for that. This bill, one, was a common vehicle that we could use as matching up with the Senate, and two, I understand is more dealing with reporting, and I guess I think Ms. Marshall could expand on that, but some of that reporting might result in different information used in the future. Is that correct,
Ms. Marshall?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, yes, that's correct. It is a reporting bill. The idea here is to have information about past due customers and reconnections and disconnections on a year-round basis so that we can understand if there is some other sorts of intervention beyond the heating season. Not necessarily financial, even on the state's part, but, you know, how might it inform how we do currently operate the energy assistance program? For example, you know, this year getting an additional federal appropriation just a couple of days ago may allow us to extend beyond where we typically say we're not taking energy assistance applications anymore because we've run out of money. We may be able to extend that beyond, and I think this is the year to do that given the anticipation that the past due bills will be higher and involve more customers.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Marshall, then, what you're saying is instead of saving any balances we have for the next year's cold weather season, we are going to potentially expend them during the whole year, so we would have to hope we get the federal government subsidy coming through again, or have perhaps another place when we have TANF money, like we use this year, from the state portion, which I understand that it's very doubtful if we ever get any more TANF bonuses with the new federal regs. So basically you're saying that if it shows that we do have a need for energy assistance, it will come out of the general fund.
Ms. Marshall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, maybe I should just step back for a second. What this bill does is provide information about what's happening to customers who are past due and or have their service disconnected and subsequently perhaps reconnected. All it does is give us annual information that utilities already report now during the cold weather rule period. What I was saying about the year-round program is that information can inform designing our current energy assistance program. It doesn't mean that we would come to any one conclusion versus another, but we would have that information available year-round. And Representative Gunther, we're very much interested in holding back some of the $29 million in order to fund your pre-buy bill.
Representative Erickson, or Representative Gunther, are you finished? Okay. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chairman Beard. Ms. Marshall, does the Public Utilities Commission now receive data for all residential customers during this this period? Not the period that's introduced in the bill, but the period that's now in place. Do they receive that data?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, they do. Each utility now reports everything, at least in the Senate version of this bill, that we've asked them to report on an annual monthly basis. So that what the Public Utilities Commission is looking at now, for example, in these reports, is how many heat-affected service disconnections in the winter, and the utilities file that information. Those reports now also include aggregate residential customer arrears, mm-hmm. how many people are past due. Most of the things that you see on that list, although it has been modified somewhat in the Senate, and that is exactly the information that we would be looking for on an annual basis, with, as I said, one addition, which is how many got reconnected on a monthly basis during the summer months.
Okay, further questions for the testifier or Chair Westrum?
Otherwise, Mr. Chair, I think
Mr. Chairman,
we want to lay this on the table.
Should we vote on it, do you think?
No.
All right. Well, the chair can just lay things on the table, so the chair exercises that prerogative. This will be laid on the table, and we'll take this up again tomorrow. Representative Westrum, House File 3542, would you like to make a motion regarding that one?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend House File 3542 pass and be referred to the House floor. And I'll ask Ms. Marshall to make comments on this bill as well.
Well, before we proceed with that, is it again, just for the benefit of the members of this committee, that your intention that we talk about this today and then lay it on the table?
Similar, yep.
Yes, okay, members, just so we're clear on what we're doing here, Chair Westrum or Ms. Marshall, proceed, please, with House File 3542.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, too, was a number of stakeholders worked to revise the version that's before you. The concept is still there. It has been edited down somewhat, but again, there is no opposition to that version of the bill that passed in the Senate committee. What this bill does is to respond to what we anticipate is a larger number of past due customers this spring and fall, given the higher energy costs and the potential for service interruptions that number may create. And so the bill it also asks utilities to report, again, how many are getting reconnected to their heating source so we can see going into the next heating season how many remain disconnected so that agencies and stakeholders and utilities and others can work to implement effective outreach strategies to let people know about the availability of LIHEAP and to get people reconnected prior to next October 15th and the next heating season. Again, with that concept intact, there is a version that I understand is being sent over here, and that version has been worked out with others, and there is no opposition to that bill.
Representative Erickson, question for the testifier.
Thank you, Chairman Beard. Representative Westrom, I have a question for you. Is that okay?
Certainly.
Thank you. Representative Westrom, when we do things like this, do we not end up paying more as customers? Because as I read 3542, and I know what happens in education, when you have to devise a plan, that's going to be costly for the utility. And they will pass those costs probably onto the customers.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true when they have to report data. Anytime we report data in K-12 education, there's a cost to it. It's never less than $50,000. So what happens in this instance? What's going to happen to the cost that may arise when a utility has to do more regulating as we're requiring?
Representative Westbrook.
Well, thank Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson. I think you're accurate in your assessment that reporting at some point costs somebody something to pull the numbers together. I don't know that this would be high dollars relative to other expenses, but I do think there would be some cost, which I do have some concern with. I had that concern when the bill was first brought to me and I introduced it, and that's why I'd like to work things out. I'd be interested in maybe Ms. Marshall has a response to that as well, but maybe somebody, one person from the utility side, could at least just address us with what they think the cost would be, because I think that'd be information that would be valuable going ahead.
Ms. Marshall, do you have an additional comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, again, this language has been revised, and the language about requiring the plan to the commission has been removed in the Senate version, and instead the bill just requires utilities to begin early contact prior to September 15th in an attempt to get customers reconnected to service, which most of them do now. Some start slightly later than that, but in my opinion, rather than costing the utility money, all we're doing is asking them to begin contacting customers earlier so that they get reconnected in the fall and can let people know about the availability of energy assistance program dollars and hopefully get them reconnected so that they don't impose costs on other ratepayers from remaining disconnected from service.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Are you just waving at me? Okay. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and probably for the author. What is the PUC taking any kind of stand on these at all, or do they have any comments or thoughts?
Representative Westrom?
I haven't heard from the PUC at all, Representative Simpson. It'll be nice to get the Senate language. We just got it here late. Or earlier this afternoon now, so we can figure out what they've done, because I know different parties had concerns with this. I'm not interested in starting from scratch. I'd just as soon look at what the Senate did and then modify from there. So I know it's a little abstract here, but I wanted to get the discussion at least started and hear some initial reactions. If there's somebody in the audience that would like to just comment briefly, sure, welcome that.
Representative Westrom, I was about to start looking in the audience, but they're all studiously avoiding eye contact with me. Mr. Haar, would you care to comment? Stand for a question or two? Ms. Turbis, would you care to say anything at this time? All right.
Mr. Chair, just so they know, I don't think you were looking for more than one-sided answers.
Mr. Haar, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the recorded record, and then Mr. Representative Simpson, do you need to repeat your question after that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission.
Representative Simpson.
My question was, thank you, Mr. Chairman, is what's the PUC's stand on these, and have you looked at these bills and have any input that will make us help make a decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mr. Simpson, we have looked at the bills, tried to assess their impact on our agency. The Commission has a sort of a longstanding policy that it really doesn't take positions on proposed legislation simply because of our unique role, the Commission's unique role, and therefore we have no position on any of these bills.
Okay, so Mr. Hari, then you would consider the policy our purview, the policy of laying down how we're going to handle this, what we're going to do, what we're going to, and you execute then on our behalf. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
You represent Westrom?
How refreshing, Mr. Chair.
Noted. Are further questions for the testifier, for anybody else we can bring up out of the audience, or what have you? Seeing none, anybody else care to testify on behalf of this bill or in opposition to this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Westrom, would you care to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, we're going to lay it over.
I'd
like to hear
from
the utilities
tomorrow or today.
Well, if any of them want to give a comment on what they came up with an agreement in the Senate, we could use take the time today, otherwise tomorrow. But we've got to get the discussion started, so whatever they... If there's anybody
here... I'm seeing a couple utilities, and they're saying no further comment to your bill. So with that, we will lay this bill on the table and with the intention of taking it up again tomorrow.
Right. Okay. Sounds good, and... We'll talk to the groups in between.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for the witnesses who testified. We now have House File 3712 next on the agenda. That would be Representative Hackbarth. Representative Hackbarth, if you'd like to move your bill, and I think is the intention here to begin the discussion again today and then table this bill. So, members, just so you know, that's what we're going to do with this bill also. Eventually, we'll be making the motion to the General Register, or which committee would be next?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that would be the motion.
Okay.
To the General Register.
This will be the last stop for the General Register. We'll go from there. Mr. Hackbarth moves that House File 3712 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register when we get to that point. But again, members, just so you're clear, we're going to talk about it today and then lay it on the table. Mr. Hackbarth, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, this is the governor's mercury reduction initiative, referred to as the Mercury Emissions Reduction Act of 2006, and which has to do with reducing mercury emissions at coal-fired electrical plants in the state of Minnesota. With that, I have talked to Mr. Eloff, and I believe Mr. Eloff is prepared to go through the bill. It's a little bit complicated, and discuss the issues in the bill. Mr. Chair, if Mr. Eloff would explain.
Representative Hackbarth, you don't have any author's amendments right this time?
I do have some amendments, but I thought we were taking amendments tomorrow.
Okay.
And we can do that tomorrow.
All right. That's fine. We'll go through the bill and then start on the amendments tomorrow after we get testified. Mr. Eloff, you want to walk the committee through the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Representative Hackbarth stated, this bill is named as the Mercury Emissions Reductions Act of 2006. Begins substantively with Section 2, which requires utilities communicating information to their customers about fluorescent lamps to state that they contain mercury, that their disposal in garbage is illegal, and also to provide those customers with a way to get information telling them how to dispose of these lamps in a lawful manner. Section 3 of the bill extends the expiration of the emissions reduction rider that's currently in statute, which is the cost recovery mechanism that utilities will use for investments made under this bill as well. It extends that rider, the sunset, from June 30th, 2006 to June 30th, 2012. Section 4 of the bill contains the definitions, the most prominent of which, I guess, relate to exactly which coal-fired power plants are covered by this bill. And those include Sherco 1, 2, and 3, and Clay Boswell Units 3 and 4, and the A.S. King plant as well. So it's a total of six plants. Section 5 of the bill requires those facilities to install continuous emissions monitors to monitor the mercury emissions from those plants. And that's important for this bill because the readings from those monitors will be used to establish a baseline against which the 90% reduction is going to be measured. Section 6 of the bill speaks to the mercury emissions reduction plans themselves that each of these utilities is required to submit to the Public Utilities Commission. It talks about the schedule on which those plans must be submitted and indicates that the initiatives in the plans must be implemented by the end of 2010 for dry scrub units and the end of 2015 for wet scrub units. It also specifies the target of 90% reduction from current levels of mercury emissions. And it also discusses the content of those plans. They'll contain different measures to reduce mercury emissions, providing data on the cost of those measures, the technical feasibility, and the amount of reductions achieved. Section 7 of the bill allows utilities to submit additional plans and associated emission reduction riders that deal with other pollutants, not mercury. Those plans must seek to implement emission controls that exceed and are implemented in advance of state or federal requirements. Section 8 of the bill refers to the riders, the mechanism for cost recovery, and it describes what costs may be included in the rider, and also that the utility may propose to phase in these riders to recover costs over the development and life of the project. Section 9 describes the review of these plans by the Pollution Control Agency, which is to review them within 180 days of their filing. And the commission is to issue a report to advise the Public Utilities Commission on the appropriateness of each of these plans. Section 10 regards commission approval of the plans. Commission also has 180 days after receiving that report from the Pollution Control Agency to make a decision on whether the plan is accepted or not. If the plan is unable to meet the 90% goal, the commission is required to order it to meet the most stringent alternative under an alternative plan that was submitted by the utility. Section 11 of the bill speaks to the implementation of the bill and directs the Pollution Control Agency to incorporate into air quality permits the mercury reductions made in these plans. And the agency is also to revise those permits within 5 years of initial operation. Finally, Section 12 talks about the relationship of this bill to state and federal regulations with respect to mercury and provides that utilities will not be required by state law or regulation to make additional investments to reduce mercury emissions. That's pretty much a walk through the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eliff, once again, describe to me where the baseline is that we're going to be measuring from here. What section?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, there are kind of two things going on here. One, where is the target coming from? Mm-hmm. And as outlined in Section 6, Paragraph B on page 2 of the bill summary, we're measuring that off a 90% reduction at what are called targeted units, and those are defined above as any coal-fired electric unit at a facility that's 100 megawatts or more. So that's setting the amount. The actual reductions can come from any units at the plant, including not targeted facilities. Does that clarify the point?
What I guess I'm looking for is a date. What's the snapshot in time from which we begin measuring?
Actually, I don't think that is clear in the bill. The emissions monitors are to begin operating, are to be installed by July 1st, 2007, and it's not stated in the bill how long those are to operate before an actual baseline is set.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ehlers. Mr. Chair, I'll have to think about that for a little while.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Simpson?
Representative Hackbarth.
Oh, Hackbarth. There you go.
Maybe we could have the MPCA come up and maybe they could answer some of that.
Right.
Great.
Why don't we have
Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Thornton from the MPCA, why don't we have them, and then Mr. Bull, would you want to say anything about this?
Not once I ask you.
Okay. And we've got a couple others that have asked to testify, Bill Grant and Mr. Peters, if we get to that. Mr. Thornton, welcome to the committee. Tell us about the bill from your perspective, and maybe you can answer Representative Beard's question. Please identify yourself for the record.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. First, I will speak about the baseline. It's essentially covered in Section 5 of the bill that starts on page 2. It says that by July 1, 2007, a utility that owns one of these qualifying facilities shall install, maintain, and operate continuous mercury monitoring systems. And the intention was that the information from those continuous monitoring systems would be used to set the baseline from which the 90% would be measured. It also does provide, though, for alternative methods of determining the baseline if that's appropriate and if it's approved by the Pollution Control Agency. And the situation that I think might occur there is that if the continuous emission monitors, which are a very, very new technology for mercury, are not yet quite up to snuff at this point in time, although we think they will be, it does provide for alternatives, which would probably constitute some degree of stat testing for emissions. Also, there is the possibility, given the schedules that are laid out in this bill, that one or more of the utilities with qualifying facilities may be ready to propose an emission reduction plan at about this same period of time, in which case we'd have to make allowances for the fact that they hadn't installed the continuous emission monitors at that time, or at least weren't required to. They could do that in advance of this date, or we could establish the baseline through testing, as I indicated.
So, Mr. Thornton, Representative Wood brought up the question, but how long will they test it to set the baseline?
Mr. Chairman, right now the way that emissions are tested for mercury from utilities is through taking stack samples, and it's a fairly expensive and cumbersome process, and very few stack samples are generally taken over a period of time. A continuous emission monitor is just that. It's attached to the facility. It is continuously measuring the mercury emissions in the stack. And I would say a really good period of time for establishing baseline conditions would be several months. The longer the better, because there is going to be some variability in the content of mercury in the coal and the performance of the facility, but we could probably reasonably establish a baseline over a period of a few months.
So leaving it open in the bill, doesn't that kind of leave it kind of open-ended or arbitrary at some point? I mean, you certainly wouldn't be using the baseline once the new technology is in place, would you? And you'd need to have it set well in advance of putting in the new technology, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I think that the way the time frames are set out in the bill for most of the facilities that are going to be involved in this legislation, we're going to have plenty of time for the continuous emission monitors to be operating to set an adequate baseline. The situation where I think we do need some flexibility is if one of the utilities wants to come in very early and propose an emission reduction project, and we're led to believe that that may actually be the case, then we would need the flexibility to establish the baseline in another manner, and that would most likely be through a series of stat testing that they do approved by us that we think establishes a reasonable enough baseline.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Thornton, I don't want you to think I know more than I know about this, but I do pay attention to these things, and particularly from the way the industry works. I was aware that about 18 months, 2 years ago, the federal government had awarded a grant to a pilot facility, I believe in Superior, for a new bagging technology that was supposed to take in excess of 90% of the mercury out of a flu stream. And boy, I wish I could put my fingers on the article now, because it was, as I recall, the guy writing the article was pretty lit up that mercury extraction technology was really difficult, expensive, unpredictable, but they thought that maybe this was going to achieve mercury reductions in excess of 90%. I remember that number. I remember thinking, wow, it must be tough to get it out. But the baghouse was phenomenally large for the size of the boiler that was being treated. And this is only within the last 24 months or so. So I guess I'm just a little concerned, or I'm questioning how fast the technology is growing and changing. Is this going to be worse than cell phone stuff? So we mandate they buy the latest gizmo today, but by golly, tomorrow there's something newer and better that they can trade up to. Only these aren't cell phones. These are power plants, for crying out loud. What can you tell us about the way the technology is moving, or maybe Representative Hackbarth, if there's another witness that's coming that can talk about this, I can withhold the question, but Mr. Thornton just seemed like a good opportunity at the moment to ask that. Where are we going with this technology? How is it moving? What's the state of affairs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, it's actually a very good question, and I'm not familiar with the testing that was done up in Superior, so you know more than I do about that. But in general, the technology for removing mercury from coal-fired power plants is escalating very, very rapidly, even while we speak. Largely fueled by the fact that EPA promulgated their federal clean air mercury rule, one of the rules that we're trying to actually do better than here with this legislation. And a number of individual states, about three or four at this point, have also enacted their own mercury control rules. So what we thought we knew about mercury control for power plants a year or 2 years ago is completely changed. It looks like there's lots of reason to be very optimistic about what can be done. There seems to be some general consensus about the ability to control mercury emissions from newer facilities that have dry scrubbers and baghouse filters. There is a difference between Eastern Coal and Western Coal. Eastern Coal has more mercury in it, but it also has more chlorine, and that makes it easier to control at these kinds of facilities with traditional pollution control technology. Western Coal, much lower in mercury content, which is a good thing, but harder to capture that form of mercury that is emitted when the coal is burned. It is looking, however, like 90% is very achievable through a technology which is essentially injecting activated carbon that's been treated with bromine into the flue gas of the plant and collecting that along with other particulates within the baghouse filters. And that's not that expensive compared to other kinds of pollution control equipment that plants have. What is much more uncertain at this point, but becoming less uncertain as time goes on, is the way to achieve a high level of mercury control at wet scrubbed units. And that's one of the reasons why there's language in this bill that's a little less straightforward than you might think about giving the PUC the opportunity to look at something other than a plan that achieves 90% control. If to do that, it just costs simply more than people are ready to pay, or if it's not even technologically feasible. And we think that certainly by the time we get around to getting plans for those wet scrubbed units, it can be done. And if not 90%, certainly very, very close to 90%. So there is some tension between the availability of technology and what we're trying to achieve, but it's the gap between what we want to do and what can be done is closing very, very rapidly, and I think there's every reason to be optimistic that the goals in this legislation can be achieved.
Any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton, I wanted to continue the conversation we'd had about multi-pollutant reductions. If you went on page 4 and the other environmental improvement plans, and just if you could elaborate on, you know, how this works with some of the other pollutants that are out there we have requirements here for mercury reduction plans, and then we say that a utility may also propose plans. Could you just describe how that would work?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There are some other federal requirements that our utilities are going to have to be meeting over the next period of time, 10 years plus. One is the Clean Air Interstate Rule, which requires it's basically a cap and trade program for the eastern states, Minnesota being one of the westernmost states in that control area, for sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides to help reduce fine particulate matter and to help reduce ozone, urban levels of ozone. There's another rule that we are working on that's a federal regulation that requires us to improve visibility in Class 1 areas. A Class 1 area is a federal wilderness area or a national park, and the likely strategies for doing that will also look, among other sources, at power plants and their SO2 and nitrogen oxide emissions. So it's quite likely that our utilities, while looking at mercury controls, are also going to be looking at ways to reduce these other pollutants at the same time. And there is a tremendous benefit, potentially, to the environment and to public health if they do it all at once. Because if, for example, they choose to, at one of these wet scrub units, choose to upgrade the scrubber system and the filter system to a dry scrubber and a baghouse, then that means that the mercury controls that they can achieve are certainly more certain, but also probably a higher degree of mercury control is possible. And so it really is a good thing to be able to consider multi-pollutant control options, and that's exactly what Section 7 here in this bill provides for.
So, Mr. Thornton, on that issue, I'm not sure I followed you right. I think what you said was if they install more multi-pollutant reduction systems, they might not get quite as much mercury, but they might get several more of the other pollutants that the two would offset themselves. Did I understand you right?
Mr. Chairman, actually, what I was trying to convey was that while if they did a multi-pollutant approach, they would get more reductions of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, but there's a better opportunity to get more reductions for mercury as well under that kind of a scenario.
Yet they don't have to install that under this legislation.
This legislation doesn't speak specifically to the SO2, NOx, and other pollutant controls, but it does provide a method for them to come in and propose those emission reduction projects and qualify for them for approaching the PUC for rate adjustments.
Cost reimbursement. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Thiessen.
Same, it's more of a procedural question. Do we have copies of the amendments for tomorrow?
We've got them. They're not in the packets yet, but I said they're available if your staff wants to get them, or if you want to get them, we can get them out. The reason we didn't want people laying them out and then have to recopy them for tomorrow, but they are available. So at least the ones that have been turned in. And Members, if there's other amendments that you do want, I've been contemplating, and what I think I would do is waive the 24-hour rule and try to have them in by noon tomorrow if you have other amendments on this issue. But we've got some in already, and so you can get them from our staff. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Westrom. You would like us to just refile these three bills we've reviewed, correct? So that we don't have to run them
again. Right. Please put them back in your packets, or else don't cry when you don't have it to look at tomorrow or next week. With that, I think we're at a natural breaking point. Mr. Thornton, I'm wondering, and maybe there's somebody in the future that would testify to this, but I'm curious if anybody's done a scan of mercury reduction technologies that have been studied by the Department of Energy through grants or pilot projects. Is there anybody in your office that would know anything about what's out there that realistically looks like it's been working and is reasonably cost effective? Do you have any of that information that you'd be able to bring us?
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, our engineer that's been working on this is in Arizona this week on vacation, so I'm going to be a little bit at a loss to be able to explain that sort of thing myself. We did, there was a presentation in the Senate from a gentleman who had quite a bit of control technology slides, and we could certainly bring those in. And I imagine between a number of the parties, we could probably put together a brief discussion tomorrow if that would be helpful.
Well, I think it would, Mr. Thornton, and because, I mean, I think we need to know. It seems to me the Department of Energy has probably done some stuff on this, and maybe utilities know what they likely would know what's out there. But it would be helpful, I think, for our committee members to know that there is something out there, or, you know, if there isn't, I think that changes the perspective a lot, because if we're going to be blazing new ground here with Minnesota ratepayers, yeah. I think we need to know that as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you want to take a few more minutes this afternoon and talk about that further, we can do that. We wouldn't be proposing legislation like this if we didn't think it could be achieved. The primary method of reducing mercury at power plants, as the technology stands right now, is going to be the introduction of a powdered sorbent. At least for dry scrub units, it's going to be the introduction of a powdered sorbent in the flue gas, and in collection of that along with the rest of the fly ash and particulate matter. And right now, for Western coal, it's looking like brominated activated carbon is the sorbent of choice and can achieve removal rates of mercury in the 90%+ range. At least that's what some of the experts have been touting. The ability to control...
Mr. Thornton?
Yes, sir.
And I hate to cut you off. I understand one of the witnesses that had asked to testify can't make it tomorrow.
Okay.
I'm wondering, would it be all right to suspend where we're at and... So you kind of understand the question, and we could just dive into that tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, we can do that.
Would that work? And if you could work with the groups, people you know that have that information, I think it would be nice to know what the DOE has funded or not funded and what some of the results have been, what technology might be out there. If you can take note of that, that'd be great. And appreciate your flexibility. And... Mark Peters?
Yes. I've got an advocate here. Wanted to be a part of this today's.
Right. Thanks for letting us know, and we'll.
I'll just hop up here.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much.
We're getting towards the end of our time here, but if you could identify yourself for the record and share your concerns or
for support or opposition to this bill. Thank you, Representative Westrom, members of the committee. I'll keep it brief. I testified for the Joint Senate Committee and kept it to 3 minutes, so I'll try to keep it no more than 5 minutes here, so for his sake and for yours. We've got ECFE tonight we need to get to, so we're going to be heading out the door fairly soon for that. My name is Mark Peters, and I'm Executive Director of Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. It's a statewide advocacy office of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. So we're a partnership with all six synods, all six bishops. They're represented on our governing board, and we're also part of the National ELCA Division for Church and Society. In Minnesota, there are over 900,000 Lutherans, about 1,200 congregations. One way I like to put it is, in Minnesota, we're pretty dense, us Lutherans. To put it here, as far as this issue here, I am an avid sportsman. I hunt, I fish. My son was up at the farm with me, you know, making turkey blinds, and he's out in the pier in Como Lake catching fish and hauling them in. He's often out in the boat with me. And this is Noah here, and he's part of that next generation of people that are going to be out there fishing. And like myself, I like to eat what I catch. I also like to release so that I keep it in that range there, but I like to be able to do that. And I like to teach good stewardship of catch and release as well. And the story I'd like to share with you, you've heard a lot of the science. In the Senate, there is some powerful testimony regarding health disparities. I'll touch on that. Our office deals with, in particular, hunger, health, and caring for creation. And one of the pieces on that is this. I was over at Luther Seminary this afternoon at a children's summit and doing a workshop on advocacy. And this issue of mercury connected all those issues, health, hunger, and the environment. It's one of those equal opportunity neurotoxins, if you will, mercury. And one of the areas in hunger is that in Minnesota, roughly 48% of the food shelf users are children, according to the recent surveys, both Second Harvest, Heartland, and Hunger Solutions. Those types of, and disproportionately people living in poverty, of course, are affected by hunger, and so the health disparities from people in particular, especially children, who rely on fish for part of their diet, are disproportionately affected. The story that I'd like to tell is about fishing on Como Lake. Like we do often, it happened last summer. Noah and I were out at the end of the pier, and we were dipping our line in the water. We'd been digging some earthworms out of the garden, and we weren't having a lot of luck that day, although you did catch a nice perch. Yeah. Caught a nice perch in the sunny, and we were catching and releasing, and on the other end of the pier is full of people. And the way I describe it is there was a pregnant Hmong woman I came to know with six children, and they all had their fishing poles, if you can picture this, up and down the pier, and a bucket filled with water. And they were hauling the fish in. And we went over to, I mean, Noah was interested in our couple of fish, but the way they were hauling fish in, we became a little bit more interested in what they were catching and walked over there. And they were using silkworms. And that was a trick that day. And they were filling their bucket with fish. And I asked them what they were going to do with the fish in that bucket. And they were taking them home to eat. The bucket was just teeming with fish. They come there many times during the week to fish. I wonder how often this story is repeated throughout Minnesota. I wonder, with American Indians who rely on fish as a staple part of their diet, they are affected by this. I wonder what type of science we're doing. There's been a lot of attention in the media recently about lead in this pendant that was sold. But the neurotoxin of mercury is more invisible in some ways. I'm not going to go into the science of it. I'm here more to share this story. I want to finish with a piece because one of the sections that I've often heard is not a lot of the mercury that ends up in Minnesota lakes comes from Minnesota power plants. And somehow, to use a pun, we're off the hook. Or we're not responsible as much to address this. But my faith tradition,
speaks of connection, how we're all connected. And when I was hearing some of the back and forth during the Senate committee hearing, I thought to myself about that connection between us. And then I thought of my son and my almost two-year-old, who's going to be starting to fish. And I thought about, does it matter if it's my own kid or someone else's kid? Someone's going to be downwind of the power plants we're talking about. And we're quibbling around the edges if we're passing the buck on who's taking responsibility. It strikes me that this is a time to use the existing technology because mercury is preventable. And as we measure the cost of technology, especially, to think about the cost of if we don't act. A lot of this is not measured, mercury. We don't study it as much as we do some of the other neurotoxins. We don't simply know on some of this, although we're learning a great deal. We know what exists. You can read the fish advisories and so forth. I think the cost of delaying or weakening the legislation that's before us right now might result in greater costs in the long term for our state, for our nation, and indeed for anyone who's downwind. And that's really the message I wanted to bring for you today. I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Peters.
Thank you.
Any quick questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Western. Mr. Peters, are you speaking on your own behalf?
I'm speaking on behalf of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, who's been on record both nationally and at the state level about the importance of regulating and reducing mercury because it is one of those preventable neurotoxins we must address.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
So you're speaking on behalf of Lutherans?
On behalf of the ELCA social teaching and policy, specifically the Caring for Creation social statement, and the sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all economic life social statement, which speaks to this issue in particular.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Peters, have you surveyed us Lutherans?
That was passed by a clear majority. I think it was close to unanimous during the 1993 churchwide assembly of the Lutheran Church in America. Yes. So, I mean, as close to the legislative process, I can't say that all Lutherans agree. They don't. They're divided on issues. But in their elective, the places that set the policy for the Lutheran Church, particularly in regards to environment, they are in uniform agreement on this piece that mercury is something that needs to be addressed. And there are people that disagree with that as well. But as a church body, that is the policy that governs our denomination.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Mr. Peters, thank you for your input, and
you.
Glad we were able to fish in today. Good luck fishing this summer.
You too.
With that, members, we will lay this bill over, Representative Hackbarth's bill, and we will see everybody tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.